Welcome to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Aviator Zone Podcast. With your host, Captain Felipe Santiago. Flying stories, career advice, and a lot of hangar talk. Let's talk aviation.
Hi, and welcome back to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Mike Schieflit. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So Mike is a very diverse aviator. He's an ATP both in the U.S. and in England. He's also been a former DP in the United States, an examiner in England as well. 16,000 hours. I can imagine you have a lot of stories to talk about.
you can imagine. There's a lot in that.
Awesome. So not only is he a very diverse pilot, but he's also the CEO of Bootcamp CFI. We'll talk a little bit about what you do with that. And also you have a podcast, which we'll talk about as well. Mike, welcome. Let's get started with how you got into aviation. What sparked this interest?
Well, you're going to really find that fascinating. So I'm going to tell you the truth. A friend of mine, we went out to a bar, and we started drinking, and I told him, I bet him $100 that I would learn how to fly. And the next day, it's one of those things that still sounded like a good idea, so I started flying that next day. And then in about 2.5 months, he owed me $100. And at that time, we could
rent. $100 was a lot of money probably
We could spend, so we spent $26 an hour for the airplane. So we basically used that money and flew 4 hours. And I paid a little bit. That's what happened. That's how it started.
So where did you learn to fly?
I learned to fly in San Jose, at the old Fremont Airport. It's Fremont, California. And then I moved to Los Angeles for a while. And then I was back in the Bay Area, and I finished at Reed-Hillview Airport, at a place called Aerotrends, at the airport that doesn't have leaded fuel anymore.
Very famous one. Actually, we were just coming back from Red Bird migration, and we were talking about fuels over there. So that's another very interesting topic. Learning to fly at that airport, how do you feel about that whole? No more avgas there. That would be your home airport, no?
Yeah, it was, but I didn't live too far from there, but they've been trying to close Reed-Hillview Airport for at least 25 years. So, in fact, the person I was involved in that original setup with a girl named Amelia Reed. She had Amelia Reed, one of the first female aviators that were aerobatic pilots and show pilots, and a guy named Bill Dunn, who had an organization called CRAMP, Coalition of Responsible Airport Management and Policy. So he founded that, and then AOPA hired him as their VP of Regional Affairs, and he retired from AOPA about a couple of years ago, and he did all Save the Airport stuff. So they've been trying for a long time to close the airport, so any reason they can get.
So it's not like this whole lead is so much of a big deal. It's just they're using that as an excuse to find a solution to close this airport.
It's contaminating the ground. The people who live around it are being poisoned by lead, this kind of thing. It was a good story, but of course it's not true. So that's the part. And so they've been trying forever, any reason they could find. The airport is not the best looking airport. You know, they don't put a lot of money into it, but they accept a lot of money from the FAA. To put money into it, right?
And then where does the money go?
Who knows? That's what everybody would like to know. There was an impact study done, economic and environmental impact study that was done on that airport about maybe 20 years ago. And the result of it was, it was funded by the county, so they had to pay $250,000 for the study. And it basically said that any other use of this property outside of an airport would cause more crime, more pollution, more deaths because the density would be higher. So the airport's the best use of this property.
So I'm sure they hit that like report. That. Yeah, it's like, we don't like this. This goes against our plan here.
And it almost closed in that year because the current, there was a supervisor, a county supervisor, and I can't remember his name. He became the mayor of San Jose, and he was voting to close the airport. And the city said, if you ever want to be mayor or you want to be in politics here, this is a reliever airport for American Airlines. Oh. You can't vote that way. And so he changed his vote the last minute, last hour. Yeah, I forgot his name, but I will think of it in a minute. It wasn't Ron Dirudon. It was another one. But yeah, so that was our involvement.
So you have a very diverse background.
Yes.
Aviation was not your first career.
No.
So what was your first career? Where did that lead to?
So first things were generally engineering, physics, human factors, that kind of thing. So that led me to my first job was at Ford Aerospace. That was as a satellite engineer. I was a vehicle engineer for the INSAT 1A, first kind of weather satellite, comm satellite for India.
Wow.
Yeah, there was. We made two of those, and they had visible light satellites I could finally see the weather in India. And then we also worked on the Intelsat. I forgot the name. Intelsat 3 or 6, which was a comm satellite. These were geosynchronous.
So you worked on stuff that's been in space.
Yes, exactly.
How does that feel?
Well, we didn't get to go to space, but my name's up there. Well, it was up there because one thing that's fun is that when you work on the satellite, they would call us Sparkies, which are the people, electrical people. And then with mechanical engineers, you can imagine what we called them. They were out the ones wrenching and torquing things. So we get access to the propulsion, and they had tape that they wrapped around, reflective tape, so it didn't overheat. And we all stuffed our names in there. Before the satellite was launched, so we did actually get into space. Our names at least got up there, but ourselves didn't.
Right, that's pretty cool, though. Yeah, I mean, knowing that there's stuff that you put in there.
There is. It's very interesting stuff. We had a liquid helium pumping station where we could pump down the satellite. You know, like we called it the pumpkin. It looked like just a chamber, so you could pump it down to get rid of to lower the atmosphere. And we had shock and vibration. We had to take that over to Lockheed. Which had a vibration and a sound chamber, so we could test for vibration, resonance in the system, that kind of thing. Yeah, there was a lot going on there. And then we got to go to Cape Canaveral and launch them.
Wow.
So that was kind of interesting. So the only problem I hated was we had three different shifts. We had a morning shift, a swing shift, and a graveyard, and we had to rotate through those every 2 weeks.
So it was a tough schedule.
Fun. Yeah, that wasn't so fun. Like air traffic control does a similar thing. Yeah. That wasn't so fun.
I always see these like launches from Elon Musk, and I see like the whole team waiting just to see this thing go in the air. And it's got to be, you know, something just crazy knowing that.
Because you have a station. So my station was a solar array for the inset. And so, you know, when it didn't come down, all eyes were on me. And I'm like, what? And so they had a little LED. So when the actual arm would come out, there were these things called squibs, which are explosives, and they would keep the satellite, the arrays close to the satellite, and then the squibs would fire, and it would cut the wires, and they would come down. You couldn't do that under gravity because they wouldn't be able to withstand it, but in space, it was fine. So when it hit the end, that light would come on.
That's
so
like your log, like a gear switch.
It didn't come on. So, and if you're smart enough, you look over the temperature of the solar panel, which you can see, and you see the temperature coming up. So you know that it's getting
sun. Working.
So it's working. This is how good. So then what did they do? They do like any good person would do. Instead of taking a hammer, they took the thrusters and shook it, and then the rest of it came down.
So it's basically like an airplane with an emergency gear extension.
Yeah, that's pretty much the emergency
gear lock extension. You got to shake the wings and see if it locked.
Yeah, then come down. You didn't get 3 green. It's in this case, 1 red, but that's what it was like.
That is pretty crazy.
It was an interesting job. I didn't stay there very long, just a few years, but it was an interesting kind of work.
So you got your pilot's license, and then at some point you made a shift in careers to aviation.
So what I was in the semiconductor electronics business, the back end of the semiconductor stuff. So that means that once a chip is done, it would go out to the field. And then if there were failures, it would come into a group called failure analysis, FA, we call it failure analysis. So I worked in failure analysis, and so I was responsible for determining why it went wrong. And then we would give design changes to the engineers to make the next set, or if it was a prototype set, whatever it was. So we did that, and then that was my job for a while, was doing that, because my background was in kind of physics stuff. So basically I knew I was in a room full of electrical engineers as the best mechanical engineer, in a room full of mechanical electrical engineers, the best chemist, right? So it's like you're not really good at anything, but you know, you have a general oversight of the thing. So I worked in that, and then I got fired from every job I worked. Well, almost. Either got fired or got close to getting fired. So, you know, I left in enough time. That's pretty good. So the last job that I got fired from, then I started my own company. And so I've been self-employed since 1987. And so then that's what got me into aviation, was because I had this little company. It was 10 people. We needed space to make manufacturing, so small things.
What were you manufacturing?
We're manufacturing offline inspection equipment. So basically this big machine would come and look at the wafers, which had all the chips in it, and determine if there were some irregularities. And if there were, then our little system would go to those exact locations. You could do things. You could probe it with a probe, or you could take a little laser and zap out a piece of it, or if you wanted to, that kind of thing. So
wow.
We had that. Yeah. So where did I find up manufacturing? Right next at the airport, Reed Hillview Airport, because the space was cheap. And there was a flight school next door. And I had a private instrument rating, so I finished my commercial. And then this is the point where the business was, our next leap of faith was going to be a $50 million investment, or capitalization. And we weren't going to be able to do that. We were a minor player anyway. So I licensed off that technology, and then I became a flight instructor And then we started another company called Nice Air Express, which was accelerated flight training. And it was niched, right? So we niched it out. That worked pretty good for a while. And then I become a DPE with, I was living in England. I had 2 hours more PAC than I needed to qualify. And I was instructor 1 month longer than I needed to qualify.
Wow. Yeah, that so was, right at the minimums.
You yeah, got right there. At the, I was flying there to try to get the time. So I would just rent an airplane and just fly around just to build up enough time to have the 2,000 hours of PAC that I needed.
So with that process of going from a U.S. ATP, so at this point you were just a commercial single-engine, multi-engine CFI.
No, I had an ATP from here.
You already had an ATP. Yeah. And then, so you became a DP first in the U.S. or overseas?
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
So then after that, you started, at what point did you start going into Europe and getting your stuff transferred over
well,
there?
Well, that was because we wanted to do EASA, which wasn't called EASA then, it was JAR. So we wanted to do UK training in the U.S. and that was allowed.
And then, is it still allowed now?
No, it is, but it's only through EASA. It has, so everything has to be approved through EASA.
So it's funny that we talk about this because not too long ago, I was looking into doing some training outside of the United States.
Yeah.
And I started researching, and basically it's not in the interest of the United States to conduct training outside of the United States. So you have to, I guess you could have a student, you couldn't even have them solo. So you can do the training, but you couldn't do any of the solo training, and you couldn't do the check ride.
Yeah, you have to do dual training to get them to be fall under the EASA rules as well. So yeah, it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
You can do this at U.S. military bases because they're flying under a different set of rules.
And I also saw that if you have, like, let's say, for example, if you're a private, my understanding is if you have an airplane, let's say you're an American citizen and you are living in Costa Rica and you want to have an FAA inspector come in and do a check ride for you, they could do the check ride outside of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But you are a U.S. citizen outside of the United States. If it's somebody international, then it wouldn't work.
Right. They don't have to. Right. So they don't have to provide the service. That's the thing.
Which I'm sure they're doing it to protect the U.S. Businesses, right? So that you can't go and get a license in South America or Central America. You have to come to the United States.
There's one or two DPs in Europe that will do tests, FAA tests. So that it's quite expensive because they got to travel. One lives in Cologne in Germany, and the other lives in the U.K. So there are two that actually do that, but it's not their full-time business.
I wonder if they have boundaries as well for medicals. Like, can you get a medical outside?
Yeah, you can get an FA medical in a lot of countries. Yeah, that you can do.
Yeah, I didn't know. I figured it's probably something to do with the same thing here, right? You want to protect that industry here, but it wouldn't make sense if you live in England and you want to go get a medical. You don't have to deal with all those stuff.
Yeah, there are some examiners that could do both when I was there. And if the first one you had to do with CAA at their facility. So it takes a full day, sometimes 2 days. There's blood tests, chest x-rays, there's epilepsy tests, all kinds. You can imagine.
If we had this in the United States, half of our pilots wouldn't be pilots.
Yeah, unfortunately, not all falling out of the sky. So I think the system works okay.
I think it's
sometimes it's on the other side, it's a little too much.
I agree. I mean, it's funny that you bring that up, right? We talk about this, but really, we won't really have these problems in the U.S.
Well, it's sometimes there's a solution looking for a problem, right? In that case. So the reason they did this, they have had 16 different written exams, right? And you can't know the questions because every one of those has its own test pool, like mass balance, weight and balance. Here, among all the tests, ATP all the way to mechanics, there's probably in the order of 50 or 60 questions total. There in mass balance, there's like 500, 600 questions just for that. So there's no way you're going to memorize these.
Right, there's no memorizing.
So these ground schools that I had to take were very long. I mean, the first one was 3 months and the second one was 6 months to get the equivalent of the ATP. That was just for that. But the problem there is you didn't need a four-year degree to fly. They found that's kind of silly. Why do you need that? This is a vocation. It's not a thing that needs a four-year degree. So this was the way to put up the fence post so everybody wouldn't be a pilot. Whereas here we had the four-year degree that got in the way. That was kind of the idea of it. Well, I mean, outside of that, the UK system is pretty bare. The thumb comes down onto you until the last second. And when you've cleared all the tests, then the thumb comes, welcome to the club. But until then, it's going to stay right on your head.
Right? Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it hasn't changed yet, right? No. And they must have been having the same problems that we're having with pilots, right?
Yeah.
And they pay way less.
Yes,
I know. I saw the other day a meme. It was like the U.S. pilot has got a thick stack of cash going like this all over the table, and then you had the European pilot with like a five euros, and then some coins going like this. Like, I got my paycheck.
Funny. There was a joke.
Fun of that, like
when the 7-4 was the biggest thing flying, or they say, why is there a hump? in the top of the 7-4 so the pilot can sit on the wallet. that was the joke.
No, but it's true. I mean, you even in South America, right? You have some of these guys that are captains on 7-8s, and they make less than an FO in in the States, which is crazy.
But the thing is, they don't need sometimes in the countries they don't need a lot of money. So in India, for example, when I was doing a lot of training for Indian students, they all wanted to be pilots. I said, "Why do you guys not want to?" Because they had no interest in aviation, a lot of them. And I said, "Well, you know, a doctor engineer makes about $2,000 a month, and that gives you apartment, that gives you a 2-bedroom, give you everything, go out to eat every night, you can have someone to cook, someone to clean, someone to drive, whole thing, right? For $2,000 a month." Pilots were making starting pay $3,000 a month, and within 6 months they were going to $4,000. So they all wanted to be pilots, whether or not, whatever.
It wasn't a passion, it was just a matter of the money.
It was the money.
I feel like we're seeing that more now because it's becoming so, sexy. It's like you can be a pilot, make some money. Yeah. Everybody wants to be a pilot now. And you see the energy in the cockpit is kind of different, because you're not always flying with somebody that loves aviation, right?
Right, I can see that.
Like, we leave the cockpit and we're talking about airplanes. Mm-hmm. These guys, the last thing they want to talk about is airplanes when they leave. It's like, yeah, I'm done. Got it from point A to point B. Don't That's talk to me. Don't call me. Send me the check. See ya.
Yeah.
So back to your initial start of aviation. So you got to the point you were a CFI. Yeah. Then you became an examiner.
Yeah.
How was that? How was becoming an examiner? And how was that getting that flow going at the beginning?
Yeah, that's hard. But so this is an art. So as much as people want to make it something else, it's an art form. And so it takes a while to get good at your craft. Like teaching, that's good. It takes a while to get good.
Right.
So when it first started, it was difficult because you had to write a plan of action, several plans of action. They had to be written plans of action, which the questions you were going to ask, the references, where they came from, the outcome, and then the flow of the test. Because it could be, you'd get complaints that you don't give me enough time, like, say, instrument rating. I would do instrument rating, 3 instrument approaches, and they were pretty close together. And then the complaint, oh, they're too close together. So then I say, okay, I'll spread them out. So then after that, it's, why is your flight test 3 hours long? Because I had to spread it. So I don't win. So I just chose the shortest route.
I feel like it's the same way still today. Yeah, it is that way. You can't make them happy.
No, you cannot. So it just become that. In the beginning, it was interesting work. And in the end, it became a grind because it's boring. You can say it pays this, it pays that, but you can't take the test fee and multiply that by 5 times a week because it doesn't work. There's weather, there's discontinuous, there's people not eligible. There's a lot of things in the way of that. But the getting there is the hard part. It's like being selected as an astronaut. It's really difficult.
Right. And I can see that, not only are you're crushing somebody's dream, right? So that can have some psychological effects on you too. It's like, oh man, I have to, like, something silly, right?
Yeah.
And everybody makes a mistake. I'm sure you've had a mission where you're flying a flight and you're like, I screwed that up. I could have done that better. And if you, that was been a test, you wouldn't have had a license, right. Like, so that psychological stress of going through this, and it's boring. It's the exact same test.
Yeah.
How many private pilots did you do?
1,800.
1,800
pilot. I did 3,000 total flight tests.
That's 1,800 takeoff briefings.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same questions mostly, and the same 3 airports mostly. Right.
Talk to me about the privileges of your certificate.
And you have to be careful because people will. I had a guy who said,
"You've had crazy stories. You told me all these crazy. Tell me those crazy stories on these check rides."
Well, okay, just nervousness. So, I had a guy who said this. Who said, what did he say? He's an optimizer, right? So basically he's a software guy. So he liked to optimize everything. He was nervous about one thing he was really nervous about. And so I asked him, he said, I'm just nervous about one thing. I said, what is it? He says, I'm going to tell you. I said, okay, we got to do everything anyway. So then when we go flying, now remember, he's optimized. He's basically looking for the second chance is what he's looking for. I know there's a way I can get it optimized. And he reads and he finds a solution. So anyway, I said, let's do a steep turn to the left, the very first thing. And he goes, right now? That was the thing, right? And so he banks and he starts going, right? And this thing starts to bounce towards the earth. And after about 30 degrees of turn, just when it's getting to the limit, he snaps the wings level and he goes, traffic, traffic, traffic. Right? And I say, where? He goes, it was right over there. It was right over there. So he's getting his second chance, right? And then at the end, he did confess. He said, there was traffic there, which is not true. But he said, I get about 8 out of 10 of those. It's a couple, and I had done 8 really good ones before. So, it's kind of like that.
Traffic.
And then the people, you have to ask, be careful, like how you ask a question, because the answer could still be right. So I said to the student, I said, what's VY for your airplane? He's very nervous. And he goes, 74. Yes. Okay, excellent. What's VX? And he goes, nervous as hell. So 68. I say, okay, what's the difference between the two? And he goes, six. So, you know, you never know. That's the correct answer, right?
Yeah, that's so, the difference between the two.
So you get good at questioning and getting to the point, right? You get to the point.
I can imagine. Like, what about scary? I'm sure you had a scary, you know. Well, you did mention one, right?
Yeah,
the guy with the glider pilot, right?
Yeah, so that was a short field landing. The guy was high. The person was not high. I mean, altitude-wise, right?
I hope so.
Yes, yes. And they were, this is a glider pilot. So there's an additional rating, the airplane single engine land. And so at about 800 feet, I told him, it looks like you're high. You know, I was giving him like a chance here, right? And he took the stick, the control wheel, and he shoved it all the way to the forward and held it on the stop. And the airplane went vertically down.
You're pinned to the roof.
Yeah, all my heads, everything came off. The tow bar, everything's flying around, right? And I can't break him free of this, you know. It doesn't take long. So I did get the flaps up really quickly so that we didn't overspeed the flaps.
And you were how high?
800.
800 feet.
So yeah, and then finally when I got him to release the controls, I was pulling out of the dive. The airspeed was past VNE, past. And so then the ground was coming up really quickly. So at about maybe, I'd say 100 feet, and then I couldn't land because they're so fast, there's no way for me to make a landing on this short runway. And I thought he was trying to kill us, so I didn't know what to do with him. I just told him, don't touch anything and don't look at me. And so I went around, and they said, do you need some assistance? And I said, I'll let you know. And he didn't seem like he was being crazy now, so I stopped, and it was a glider instinct. That, you know, you can have all the stuff out and you can stick it all the way forward and it won't overspeed. Well, it will in an airplane. And then the panic of the test, right? So, you know,
he just reverted to what he always knew.
Primacy, right?
Primacy.
Yeah, that's it. That's what happens.
Talking about primacy, I think this is something that we spoke in migration.
Yeah.
And something that I see a very good future in, but I'm concerned, and especially because of the law of primacy. AOPA, Civil Air Patrol, they all have these like high school and elementary school programs that they have for their kids. And a teacher can go into this class, pick up this curriculum and run it.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have to be pilots.
Right.
What do you feel about having somebody that doesn't have a license going into a middle school and a high school and teaching aviation?
I don't think it's a great idea. I mean, I think you have some background. You don't have to be a full-on pilot, but you need some experience in this to teach it. Don't you think? You're teaching something because you're supposed to know something.
Right.
Right? And how can you know something if you're not that something?
And it's something that I can definitely see this program. I would love this program to work, right? Because, you know, we have a lot of jobs in aviation that people don't even realize, right? It's not just a pilot. It's a dispatcher, the fueler, the person that brings cleans the aircraft, the people that maintain the airplane, you know, the people that paint the airplane, the guy that manufactures the part that goes on the airplanes, right? There's a lot of jobs that can be done, but we're not really showing that in school, right?
What do
we show? We show doctors and lawyers,
right?
We don't show aviation. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword that you have that, you know, you can bring this education into a high school. I'm sorry, even high school, middle school, and elementary school, and start to feed this dream for these kids. And then eventually they come out of high school and say, hey, I want to go to flight school. I want to be a flight attendant. I want to be a mechanic or whatever it is. Personally, I went through George T. Baker. I don't know if you're familiar with George T. Baker.
Mm-mm.
So there's a program in Miami-Dade schools that on your senior, on your high school, you can go to George T. Baker. It's a maintenance school and get your power plant or airframe for free, paid by the county for free. If you go there from your first year, you go through general, and then you take your classes, you get your hours that you need to be able to get either a power plant or an airframe. And then after you graduate, you can come back and finish your power plant or vice versa, right? People don't even know about this, right? And it's a program that's free. How many mechanics do we need? You ever see a demand for the mechanics?
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy, right? And it's just, so I'm kind of like in the middle here, like how do we fix this to bring proper education to kids and inspire them to be better, better candidates that when they graduate, they can actually join this work field and they don't learn how to fly a simulator or fly something the wrong way because that's the way that they were taught, and then they come in and apply that stuff into the airplane. Something interesting to talk about, I think, in another time, but it's something that it came up in migration, and I really wanted to talk about that at some point. Anyways, back to you. So you got your DP, you finished your DP, and then at some point you also worked on helicopters, right?
No. I worked on night vision
systems. On night vision systems. So talk to us about that. You know, we always see this in the movies, but we it's funny. The last guy we had was a helicopter pilot for the Coast Guard. And we're talking about rescuing somebody with a lighter.
Yeah.
So he was flying around and looking for these kids that were out and fishing and they were lost. And the kids started to smoke. They wanted to smoke. So they went to light a cigarette. And they're going like this, right? You can imagine that thing sparking. And the guy's like, that strobe saved your life. And it's like, no, it wasn't the strobe. It was smoking that saved your life.
One of the few times smoking saved your life, right?
So how was that? Yeah. What did you do with that? How was that technology? Tell us a little bit about that. Because I think everybody is curious about night vision.
Yeah, so I got hired there as an engineer on the M1 tank, the Abrams, and the night vision system. And then I switched over to the TOW Cobra helicopter night vision system. It's similar. So basically, it used a mechanical scanner. So you can imagine a mirror that would move left and right. And as the image would come in from the outside, the thermal image, then you could move the mirror across this array of sort of sensors, and you could paint a picture. So the problem with it was it wasn't working correctly. It was all like tethered at each end and around. The middle was fine, but the rest of it was no good. And so they couldn't figure out what was going on with it. And so I was a test engineer on that. I designed the test bed for that. I said, there's something wrong with this thing. I said, I see what's wrong with it. So all it needed, and imagine, now this is all electrical engineers. All they have is electrical engineering. So me, I had optics background, everything. So I said, this lens isn't focusing correctly. So we just need to put a piece of metal, like a tinfoil hat around it like this, and focus it on where it needs to focus, and that should fix it. And sure enough, it did. So they made a little collar, and that all of them shipped with my little collar on the edge of it. So that was the M1.
That's so cool.
Yeah, tank. And then the TOW Cobra didn't have any problems. I just was a test engineer on that. It was a different... So the M1 tank was a green display at that time. It was green. And the TOW Cobra was kind of like a red for night vision.
So is there still... Did you have a clearance? I'm assuming you had a clearance for this.
Yeah.
So that was secret clearance. Secret clearance.
We didn't need top secret. We had to have secret clearance.
Is there still stuff that you can't talk about that technology?
No, not about now. No, then, yes. I couldn't even tell you that then. Couldn't even tell you there was a problem with it, right?
Wow.
Yeah, I couldn't say that. But now you can... That's all public. That's all.
So how do you know if you have a clearance, right? At what point do you know that you can talk about a technology or you can't talk about
it? It's when it becomes in the public domain.
Oh, okay.
Or they tell you.
Right.
So up until then, you got to be quiet about it. But yeah, like the one guy just on the news recently, he wasn't very quiet about it, right?
What do you think about that? I mean, people are talking that he was such a low-ranking... Yeah.
Having access to that kind of
security. Is that something that was common?
Yeah, because in the military, people are between 18 and 20-something. So that's the idea of... in those years, you're separated from your peers by the kind of car you drive. How much money you put in your car, not the different shirt that you bought that has a logo on it is your difference. And so his difference was this, you know? And so that is really hard to, you don't get out of that until you're about 30.
Wow.
You start maturity enough to where you go like, okay, I know how to put the brakes on stuff. I know when I shouldn't say something instead of I need to be cool. So that's going to get him a lot of prison time for trying to be cool. Yeah. It's hard to teach, but it's very difficult for other people to see that in themselves. In other words, if you say, here's an example, it'll be the same as that'll never happen to me, you know?
Do you think that's the solution, prison time, or do you think that we should maybe readjust and say, maybe we shouldn't be giving this responsibility to somebody of this age?
Sure. But I don't know what the workload is in processing those documents, but they should be... I don't know how to make it more clear to somebody, but you still need enough bunch of people to do the work. So if you didn't have enough 18, 19, 20-year-olds to do it, there wasn't anybody else to do it. Wouldn't do it, right? So that's a problem. So I don't know. But giving people access, for us, you had to have need to know. So you could say you had a secret clearance, and you could say, here's this stuff, but you couldn't access any of that information unless you absolutely needed to know it, and you had to prove you need to know. So if you're... your manager said you need to know about this so you can work on that, they would give you access to those files.
You wouldn't have access to everything.
You wouldn't have access to
everything.
Oh,
it's secret. No. I can open it and read it.
No, it's need to know.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Why would you, you know, if you don't need to know, why would you?
Yeah, you don't want to know, really. I didn't want to know half of this stuff because I said, I got to keep my mouth shut now too, and I might want to say something, but you know, I didn't. I don't think. Maybe I did.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of responsibility and knowing exactly what you can and can't say.
Yeah, like right now, I'm holding a deep, dark secret. I'll tell you. I won't tell you the secret, but I can tell you I'm holding a really deep, dark secret. So one of my friends is a very famous musical director. He's a Tony nominee, and he has a musical, a new musical coming out. It's going to Broadway. It's called A Wonderful World, and it's a story about Louis Armstrong told by his four wives, and it's amazing. So it opened in Miami. Too big, and then now it's going to New Orleans and to Chicago and the Broadway. Now, it's being produced by a guy, that I can tell you his name, Tom Rogers. Half of the money is coming from him. $9 million is coming from him, and $9 million is coming from a very famous lady who you will get to know when that happens. I'll just say that she's a very famous black woman, and that's all I can say. But she's funding the other $9 million. I can't say any more about it, but there's a secret I'm holding. But if I were in a security clearance, I couldn't even go that far. Right. I couldn't even say that. So I at least told you that. So when you see A Wonderful World open in Broadway, it'll
see be good.
You'll know. You'll know who that is. You'll know who it is. Yes.
So no airlines.
No.
Why?
I didn't like it. I didn't see myself fitting in that very well because I didn't. Travel's okay, but I saw.
You do a lot of traveling with your business.
I do. Yeah. But I saw that being just like. The life that came with it, I wasn't willing to do. So basically, I didn't want to have to bid a schedule, and I didn't like that. So in the case of like when people are new into aviation, they tell them, for the most part, if all you want to do is do airline, if you want to be the biggest cog in the world's ever seen, be an airline pilot because you don't get paid on merit, you get paid on seniority. So there's no. So in your case, you do this plus, so you have an outlet for all that creative stuff, but you don't. But on the plus side of that, you don't have to take your work home either. Right. So there's no emails to answer, no presentation.
Yeah, you can't
prepare,
fit the Airbus in your suitcase.
No, you cannot. So on that side, but I didn't see myself doing that. I did a little bit of corporate. And even that was like, after the shiny jet syndrome, you know, when that finally thing is done and it's your job, you go like, well then, hi, this is my job. Hello, I guess I'm taking a high school kid to Montana with his dog. It's going to cost $9,000 each way. Wow, and I got to take an airline home because I'm not good enough to fly the jet, right? Kind of like that. Not always, but you know.
I heard a story of this lady was going to Hawaii. They have two jets, right? Oh. So the pilot was flying her and the dog. But they have a jet on standby and a crew on standby.
Oh, wow.
She has like three dogs or something like that. So she shows up to the airport. She's going to get on this jet to fly Hawaii. But she shows up late and says, one of the dogs was sleeping and I didn't want to wake it up.
Oh, my.
When it wakes up, they're going to bring it and just bring the other jet to bring the dog over to Hawaii.
Wow.
I'm like,
that's some privilege right there.
That's a privileged dog. Like if I wanted to be an animal, I wanted to be that dog. Definitely. You know, get to sleep in, and then you're going to wake up and fly on a jet on your private. Can you imagine the cost of flying? You know what it costs, right?
Well, those are bigger airplanes. They're going to be the Gulfstreams, the Global Express. They're going to be bigger.
Even a little Citation. You're talking about, $2,000 to $3,000 an hour. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and you're going, it's a long ways to Hawaii.
It is a long way.
And for a dog?
Yep.
But anyways, privilege. Yeah, so I agree with you. Yes, the airlines are awesome and all that stuff, but
yeah.
And I think it fits really on different people, right? Mm-hmm. There's some people that they want to fly and then they want to go home and not do anything else, right. And they're fine at that idle, their brain idling for, you know, 4 or 5 days and then mm-hmm. go back and do it again and keeping that cycle. For me, it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I feel when, you know, being here, I'm so like on a high cadence mm-hmm. and then I go to the airlines and it's like, this is so easy and so like relaxed that I'm mm-hmm. like falling asleep.
Yeah.
It's
that's what keeps my side interesting because, you know, I'm of the persuasion that you're born to create. When you're not creating, you're not happy. If you don't notice that about yourself, if you're not creating, you're generally not that happy. When you're creating, you're incredibly happy. And so for me, teaching is creating, right? And doing the stuff I do and at our company is creating. So I'm always happy about that. I mean, I can complain about it, but if I'm doing the other thing, just flying a jet corporate, I'm not going to be creative. I'm not going to be that happy.
Yeah, you're just filling that position of going from point A to point B.
Yeah.
Plus, I think also when you have your own business, you can set that direction, right?
Yes.
The airlines, I have to follow. I have to get that airplane from point A to point B at the time that they want me to get it
yes.
with the people that they want me to get it.
Yeah.
you get to set that direction, right? You get to say, I'm going to do this or I'm not going to do that and make that decision. Let's talk a little bit about your company. So CFI Bootcamp. What is CFI Bootcamp? How did it start? And what are you doing now?
Right. So CFI Bootcamp started because I wanted to do something in aviation still after I was a DPE. And it was like, what do I really want to do? So I can tell you how I did it. So I said flight instructor training. So I was so busy as a CFI. I mean, really busy. I don't know how busy I was.
What type of CFI were you?
I did primary
instructor. No, like what? Like, you know how everybody has like their different attitudes or?
Oh, kind of a CFI. I was very level-headed. I'm very funny on the ground, very quiet in the air.
You see that a lot. Yeah. Usually the people that are make the most jokes are very quiet in the air.
Yeah, that's true. That's what I was.
And then what was your examiner nickname?
They called me Tough But Fair.
Tough But Fair.
Do you remember what they called the one from Fasana?
Oh, my God. That was
Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary. Now, that's a bad nickname. I don't know.
And she loves it.
She loves it.
She wears all red yeah, lipstick. She is definitely Bloody Mary.
Bloody Mary. That's funny, right?
I cracked up. Yeah. I was expecting her at a migration.
Yeah, so that was, no, they just said Tough But Fair. They called me El Diablo, the devil, because my telephone number, 666, and then the last part's 3133, it's a beast and half a beast, so, you know, they said, do I really have to call that number to get Diablo. You? I said, yes, sir, you do. You call straight.
But that's a good one, Tough But Fair. I feel like if I was a DP,
that's a good one.
That'd be a good one to have, right? Like, Tough But Fair.
Yeah, I mean, you know you're going to get a fair shot at it, but you can't come underprepared, because it's not going to work for you, or me. Yeah,
it's just... To me, that's lazy. I don't want to work with lazy.
Yeah.
No. So back to CFI Bootcamp. So you started it because you had a lot of demand for instruction, and you kind of found this niche of like, these people need help.
Yeah. So the issues were that CFI training is a specialty. It's like in medicine, cardiology is a specialty, right? So you go to basic flight schools, private instructor, commercial, that's fine. There's plenty of room there. You can take really... young CFIs with 250 hours or even less than that, and have them supervise them and have them create pilots. The CFI is a whole different animal. So it's nothing to do with just students, privates. It's fundamentals instructing, practical psychology. It's understanding that. It's understanding the regulations in such a way that you can take someone from a balloon to an airplane, right? And what are the training, testing? There's a lot of moving parts to this. So it's a specialty. So we could charge more, and that sort of floated my boat. That was all right.
Yeah. Charging more money.
Yeah. Charging more, and then...
But you're also getting more, right?
Yeah.
That's something that people really... it's one of those things that really grinds my gears. Mm-hmm. When you're shopping for flight training, cheap does not always mean cheap, right?
Cheap can be very bad.
Very bad, right? Yeah. You're looking that, you might be saving 10, 15, maybe 20 bucks an hour. But those 20 bucks an hour, you do repeat an extra lesson because that place is inefficient. And it already costs you...
Yes.
More than almost the entire course, right? What you would have saved by going at a place that's a high performance or high, professional environment.
Yeah, we have a spreadsheet that we show people and say the hourly rate of our CFI is 110, 115 to 120. That's what we charge. And if you look at that compared to the whole program cost and you put $80 an hour in there, it doesn't change it by much. The airplane is what changes it. So I also did a presentation about this, and I said, if you go to a flight school and you see the prices, let's say you pick the most expensive guy, that's 100, and say the least expensive guy or girl is 70. The more expensive person, if they're experienced, they'll be able to finish you in about 15 to 20% faster. And when you look at when you would have stopped, then they're still charging for their time and for the airplane.
Right.
So the delta it gets consumed really quickly. So it's the airplane cost that's the most important factor. The dual rate is not as important. It doesn't represent the biggest piece of the pie.
Right. And again, I think, you get what you pay for, right?
Yeah.
So the more you can, the more you pay, well, not always, but the more you pay on instruction, it can be that, hey, you're getting a better quality instructor.
Yeah, especially one is specializing.
Or specialize in what you're specifically what you're working towards to. It's kind of like a doctor, right? You don't want to find the cheapest doctor to open your heart, right? You want to find the best guy.
Yes, there's a joke about that too. Do you know it? About what do you call a doctor who... bottom of the class in medical school, a doctor. Right? So we all have CFI certificates, right? But not all CFIs are created equal. I can tell you that.
Oh, absolutely. We see it here, right?
You do.
We see. We have. That's what we do, right? We hire. These are the people that we work with, and kind of develop them, and you can definitely see some that are coming in that are really, really good, and some that you're like, not going to work with us, right? No. Like, we will probably try somewhere else. Mike, you're a smart guy.
Really?
We talked about, what was it, the 8-ton pylons?
Yes, we did. Talked about 8-ton
pylons. I was thinking about this morning. It's like, I haven't done an 8-ton pylon in probably like 6 years.
Really?
I haven't taught on 8-ton pylons in probably six years. But I can guarantee if I get on the airplane, I can still fly the thing.
Okay.
You've done the math.
Yes.
Talk about that. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'd have to show you. But I can tell you the reason. So the mathematics basically boil down to this, that you're on a, when you are doing 8-ton pylons, you're at a particular speed, and so you're flying a certain radius,
radius,
especially no wind, let's say, a certain radius, right? And then if you drop your line of sight down to the ground, that will define a cone, right? So it'll define an ellipse. So, and if you have the altitude right, the point of the cone will be what touches the ground from your line of sight, and you'll pivot around that point. But if you're above that point for the speed, then it's going to not do that, right? Because now you're up on the cone, it's going to make a circle, because you can see the circle. And it's going to be either in front or behind the pylon. If you get too low, it'll be a circle behind it or a circle in front of it, but it won't be on it. So that's that. Also, you can't crab or control drift in 8-ton pylons, because if you do, then your line of sight changes. So you can't crab. So you have to accept all the drift. But it doesn't matter in the end, because the ellipse just changes, wider, it just changes.
What's your opinion as an examiner on these maneuvers that we do on these check rides?
That's the funniest question. That's the strongest question you asked me, because I think they're absolutely irrelevant. those are teaching tools, not testing things. Things that 8-ton pylons don't need to be tested, nor does Chandelle, none of that
turns.
Needs to be tested. No, that's so a teaching tool.
If you were to rewrite testing standards for a commercial pilot or a private pilot, what would you change?
Like,
what
I would make it operational. I had to make it that we have to go to another airport that's either non-towered or towered or or something like that. I'd make it as close to that as you can get. It'd be a real cross country with real emergencies, real diversions, real scenarios on the test that are that are likely to happen or could happen, right? A steep turn, when are you going to use that? Well, maybe if you're overshooting a runway, but are you going to try to hold altitude at the same time and do two of them? No. So that's a teaching tool. So we have to cut from this idea of testing. Testing is easy to that, right? You can make a test because you say it's 100 feet, it's 10. That's very objective, right? But subjective parts like judgment, decision making, those are the parts we should be testing. And those only come out of scenarios and operational flights. An airline, right? What do you do? You line check.
Line
you do
operational line. Experience.
Right, exactly. And there's a reason for that, because that's what you're going to be doing. I want to see that you can do that really well.
Right.
And that's what we need to do with pilots.
Do you think that's ever going to change?
I hope so, but I don't see it changing anytime soon.
I think if it was a point to change was when we went to the ACS, right? We went to scenario-based training and scenario-based testing.
Yeah.
But we still make you do these maneuvers.
Yes. Well, in Europe, they don't do this, right? So there are steep turns and stalls, but there are no Chandelles, lazy 8s, 8s on pilots.
You know, we still do steep turns on the Airbus, right? When I go to recurrent training.
Yes, you do, because it's part of the ATP curriculum.
So you got to do a steep turn.
45 degrees. Yeah.
When?
Never.
Right? Why would I be doing a 45-degree bank in an Airbus?
It would even let you. Will it let you?
It would. But it would bitch.
Yes, it will tell you, right? Hey, stop doing this.
It was like, why are you doing this?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Well, we'll probably get a phone call. If I do a 45-degree bank in the Airbus, I'll probably get a phone call saying, Captain, can you please explain to me? Well, it wouldn't be the chief, but it would probably be a union guy calling me saying,
can you explain to me
Can you explain to me why? Were you sightseeing down South Beach? Like, what were you doing that you did a 45-degree bank?
Bird. Missing a bird. They don't show up
traffic.
On radar,
it was
right?
traffic
over there. They don't show up on radar. It was a balloon, one of those balloons that Biden shot down and other people shot down, right? It was one of those things.
Yeah,
right?
One went by. So
yes.
I like the idea of this. It's just, I don't know if it's going to happen. I don't think the FAA would.
I don't think they're ready for it. I think it's just too hard of a test to administer. I mean,
it's very subjective. So,
yeah. So
how would you?
That's what they told us in FAA land. They said if you ever fail someone on judgment, decision making, tie it to an area of operation. Always tie it to an area of operation somehow. So make traffic pattern entry. It could be something. And you put the reason for it. Because it said it's really difficult to. All the other standards are very objective. Plus minus 100 feet, plus minus 10, pretty straightforward. But this is hard. But that's really what we need to be testing, right? The operational side of things. If you look at AOPA's focused flight reviews, they're much like that. They're much like how we should be
flying
testing.
And testing.
They're in flight, right?
What do you feel about this whole DPE issue that we have nationwide? I mean, we see a lot of it. We don't see that much here in South Florida. I think as far as the private instrument commercials, right. But we see it with multis and CFIs and stuff like that. But you have experience all over the country. What do you feel this whole DPE shortage, and what do you think your solution to that problem would be?
Well, they say that, well, the biggest solution, number one solution, is to bring all DPE oversight into Oklahoma City and not to FISDOs. That's the first thing. Because the FISDO will always say they don't have enough time to do, you can fill in the blank, give you examining authority, come base inspect you, get your 141 going, have additional examiner, we don't have the oversight for it. So let's just not make them need the oversight for it. Let's make them do what they're supposed to do, not set policy. They're supposed to do several things, enforcement, right? Surveillance, and last thing is certification. So let's just take that off the plate for them, right? And so let's bring in more DPEs and have them qualified under the ODA, which if you know what that is, remember. So it's, I'll think of the acronym, but basically it's what the airlines, not airlines, airplane manufacturers use when inspector is not available at the FISDO, can't be made available 24/7 to be at the factory. The FAA will designate a person like an examiner to do that function for the FAA at Boeing or whoever it is. And it's a Boeing employee, it could be anybody. So we can do that same process with DPEs and we can create them in that similar way.
We kind of have that with examining authority, right?
Yeah, that's the thing we should be ramping up. You know, the FISDOs say they don't want to give out examining authority. Well, they don't really have a choice, right? They're not a policy. Remember, if they say no to that, they're trying to set policy. And that is not their job. Their job is to implement
enforcement
policy.
And
yeah. So anyway, if we get enough people, then it really takes the workload off the FISDO too, because they don't have to do oversight on X-Ever 1C whenever they want to. They don't have to do it like a DPE. They don't have to
take paperwork. Is there that much oversight for a DPE? Like what is the oversight on a DPE?
Yeah, you know, it's like the minimum. If you're not high activity, so you do 100 or so tests a year, then it's one. They got to surveil you once. They got to ride along with you once a year. If you're more than that, which I was, they had to do at least two times a year. But they would just show up on occasion. You know, they got to the point where it was just like, wow, this is kind of ridiculous. I mean, and then the students never want to go. And so what did the FISDO say? What did the inspectors say? They had a script, you know, it's pretty tight script. So they said, you don't have to go today. That's true. You don't need to go. But if you don't go, then when we see that you got your certificate, we'll just retest you. We'll perform a retest. So you do two tests instead of one that you would have done today. I'm like, wow. So what we would do, I would tell them, right, how much of the test has to be done, the oral, okay? That it's got to be a complete practical test that ends in a discontent, something. So I would tell them, if you know it's going to be an observed test, just make sure you put on all the fuel. You know, just pack it all the way up, right?
Oh, no matter. Sorry, you're overweight.
Yeah. So then, but my inspector, the nicest one, he's now retired, but he was really fun. He would say to the student, he was a very nice guy, and he would put the student at ease, and he would tell the student, he would say, how much, inspector, sir, how much do you weigh? And he went like, well, I'm 200, but I could be as low as 165. That's pretty funny, right? I can be as low as 165.
Just to make it work. He did that word in balance before. He knew exactly what that number was.
Yeah, exactly.
For the most part, I think the people that I've worked and dealt with at the FAA have been fairly good people.
Yeah.
I think my biggest concern, or not concern, but my biggest demotivator, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word to use here. Okay. But it's when they say something and they can't back it up, and then it's, oh, this is what it is because I'm the FAA and that's it.
Opinion-based enforcement.
Opinion-based enforcement.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, you ask something and they answer it because, well, no, but really you should be doing this. It's like, yeah, but what is the regulation, right? Like, I understand that, you know, you should be, how do I transfer this over to a civilian where it's like, yeah, you should be nice all the time, but you don't have to be nice. You can be mean, right?
Yes.
It's my choice to be nice or be mean. Yeah. And they kind of want to have a moral compass or whatever. Maybe it's a moral compass. Maybe that's the word. And for me, it's like, I want to know what the regulation is. And if the regulation says something, if I ask you a question, can I do this? I want the answer yes or no. Mm-hmm. I don't want, well, you know, and regarding to this regulation here, you should do this. No, no. Is it a yes or is it a no? Can I do it or can I not? Mm-hmm. A funny story about that. I was sending an email to my insurance broker for one of our icons. It's like, hey, I can't do flight training on the icon, right? Mm-hmm. Sea training. No, you cannot. I'm like, okay, well, can I do a seaplane? Can I do a sea landing on the icon if I'm not doing instruction on the airplane? Well, yes, you can do that. But that was not answered. I was like, yes, you can do that. That was like, well, try to make it seem like it wasn't really clear. Like, can you do it? Can you not? And that's kind of like the stuff that I don't really like. You know, when somebody comes to me and asks me something, I'm like, I tell you straight up, like, I don't really go around that. So it just drives me nuts.
Well, it's, you know, it's their job, right? So it's the job of the FISDO to be able to tell you what you can and cannot do. There should be no, I mean, if there's a gray area, that's for chief counsel. There's other, you know, ways to interpret that, right? So if there's already a legal interpretation, that should settle it, right?
Going back to what you do professionally, what do you see as like your biggest challenge with a candidate coming in to be a CFI? Like, what is that wall? Is it the flying skills? No. Is it the attitude? Is it motivation?
No, it's usually we get pretty motivated people. Most of our students are either in their 20s career or they're after 40 doing second career. So the people after 40, they already had expectations are more set. So they kind of know what they're going to have to do. They don't bellyache too much about it. The younger ones can, but it's still a process to get through. The most difficult parts are the fundamentals of instructing. Everybody hates that. And they always ask the same question. How is it going to be tested? It depends on the DPE is the answer. It can either be memorize all this stuff, or it could be you don't have to memorize any of it because all by scenario. It could be as simple as that. And then teaching, having the functional, having BA, my first thing as a CFI examiner, I would ask you, one of the first things is, how are you going to teach someone to fly from zero to private pilot? What are you going to use to do that? And they would do everything but show me a syllabus, and they had no idea. They have it. They wouldn't open it up. And I said, well, what would you do, like, right after solo, what would you do? They'd say, well, cross-country. How do you know to do that? They go to their logbook and say, I think this is what my instructor did with me. That's their syllabus, was their logbook. Even though they, so not being able to teach from a syllabus is a problem, right?
So, again, going back to the FAA, do you think that this is we shouldn't have 61 schools, we should have 141 schools only, where people have, you know, there's no, like we say in Spanish, invento, like you can't reinvent the wheel and do whatever you want? Or maybe you can, you know, if it was a route where the FAA was like, okay, look, we understand, we're going to switch it to 141, we're going to make the certification like an application online or whatever it is, and we're going to have this oversight, whatever. Maybe restructuring the way that we do that, but require that if you're going to call yourself a flight school or you're going to be a place that's going to take money from people and produce something, that you have some type of
education. Do it in Europe. I mean, in England, we had two syllabuses that were approved by the CAA. You had to use one or the other. You didn't get a choice.
So I'm against that. So I think that would be too restrictive, right? I feel like you have probably your own syllabus.
We do.
Right. So you want to use
that. Yeah, I'm totally good with that.
And I think that you should be able to do that.
Yeah.
Right? But do you think that it should be that, okay, the FAA says, okay, if you're going to charge people for money, this is what you got to follow this type of curriculum, some curriculum. It's approved by the administrator at some point. You got to follow this.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be in favor of that because I think people get a bad, you know, you see all these CFIs who, you say, where's your syllabus? And he'd go like that, right here. Yeah, okay. Even I've been doing this for a very, very long time, and mine's still in front of me when I'm with the students so I can show them where they are and show them the results.
It's so easy. It's like, why would you not?
Yeah.
It's like flying on an airplane with no POH, right? It's stupid, not knowing the speeds, not knowing anything. Like,
but people get lazy. They do it often enough to catch most of the things they could if they did it for a long time. But it doesn't really help the student because the student doesn't see in a timeline like where they are. They just hear verbally, we're in this okay space or we're not in okay space. And that doesn't really help the student with like, well, how much of this okay space am I going to need before we get to the next good space, right? That kind of thing, right?
Well, and then you don't know, like, for example, if I was a customer and you're telling me, well, we send you to the test when we think you're ready.
Right.
Okay, well.
When is that,
right? Well, we have standards, right? If you're doing a steep turn and you're maintaining 100 feet, you should be able to move on to the next one, right?
Yeah.
If you're doing 150 feet, 200 feet, you should know.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm outside of that standard. I know that I have to repeat this. I can't meet that standard, right? There is something to grade. There's something to evaluate. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have that, or you don't show that to your students, they really don't know. You're just taking them along for the ride.
Yeah.
And
it's really subjective then, right? It's up to the, there's no standard there. That's what it makes people. Well, the student sometimes doesn't know enough to ask. It's their first day. I guess this is how aviation is, you know? But it doesn't have to be that way. You go to a good school, it's got a syllabus, curriculum laid out. You know, you know exactly if you're the one underperforming or the school's underperforming for you.
Exactly.
Right? You'll know that.
unfortunately, people don't have that education when they're first starting out to be able to make that smart decision. They basically go off of marketing and and that's it.
That's what they do.
So again, back to that question, because we didn't answer that question. What is the biggest challenge you see on a candidate that comes in and says, I want to teach? I think, well, actually, you did mention it. It was the fact that they don't have the experience of how to move forward or how to be able to teach that.
Yeah. So they can't teach. So, for example, I'll tell you one thing we do. It's different. We don't have you make lesson plans. We have you make one lesson plan on something so you can have the functional ability to do it. We have lesson plans that have been around for 100 and some years, right? I mean, we've been teaching steep turns the same. There's no reason to make your own. So we take the time instead and say, how do we then use this plan with a lesson? Where does this go? This goes in stage one, lesson four, whatever it is. And we say, this is what's got to be taught. Let's go through how we're going to teach that lesson. Right? Now that's functional knowledge. That's practical knowledge.
Super important. Right? Super important. You hear all these schools that the first thing, and we do the same thing. You're not reinventing the wheel here.
No.
We're teaching you to teach.
Yes.
And this is how this flow of this course goes. And this is how you're supposed to take this, present this to people. But a lot of people, it's like, oh yeah, go write the, before you even come to school, go write your whole CFI plan.
That takes like 6 months to do. It takes too long.
And you don't have the experience to do that,
right?
There's people that
are. You don't have that. You know why they do it? So why do they do it? Like these other competitor schools? No, our competitive schools do it because most of the people come to a CFI class, they have a plastic certificate that says commercial pilot on it, but they don't have commercial pilot knowledge. They were trained to a test or they're trained to, or they forgot it. So if you build a lesson plan, you have to educate yourself on that whole stuff and then make the lesson plan. But that's a really arduous process, right? I mean, to actually say, I don't know this, wouldn't you just rather take a course in like what you don't know and then make,
if
you
they basically
use
have
someone's
to learn
lesson
again.
Plans, right?
They got to learn again.
Yeah,
they're learning to fly again.
Yeah, it's the same with the CFIs. Some of the CFIs who teach CFIs don't understand the fundamentals instructing. And so what is their answer, right? So when you say, hey, we're going to do human behavior this week, and what should I prepare for? And so that instructor says, why don't you make a lesson plan on that? Because they don't know either, right? Whose lesson is it? Now it's their lesson, right? Because they don't know. Then they have the aviation instructor's handbook open while you're looking at all the red things. They're like, oh, I think that's right. That's
You just wrote a book about the...
We did.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
So that's called the... the aviation instructor's handbook is pretty
dense. Have a funny story, though, about that aviation instructor. Let's hear it.
You want to hear the funny story? I'll give you the funny story. So during two Oshkoshes ago, I was supposed to give a little talk at the Safes dinner, right? There's 200 or so people show up to that. So sometimes I do a little thing on that at the end usually. So anyway, I was preparing what I was going to do. And it was going to be on this aviation instructor's handbook. And what I was going to do is say, here it is, the new aviation instructor's handbook. It's about that thick. And I was going to say, no other country or very few countries in the world use something like this. And yet they still make pilots that don't follow the sky. And they seem to make them at the right time. I said, there's one place this book belongs. And I just was going to throw it right in the trash, right? But before, that was my preparation. And then I was going to talk more practically about it. Before, so I went to Safe's booth, and I was about ready. I was talking a little bit about this, and I was saying that this new book came out, and talking to a lady there, Donna. And after I said what I said, she said, well, I wrote most of that book. And I'm like, oh, boy, it's going to leave a mark. What am I going
to
do? And
I
did recover. So the way I recovered is I said, okay, let me rephrase that. That's a good way to start for those of you. And I said, what I don't like about it, I said, it's great if you've been a teacher for a while. You could really understand it. But if you haven't, there's nothing, you can't make each chapter operational. So you can't say, what do I take out of this and where do I put it? What do I do with it, right? It's just theory. So I wrote a book called The Aviation Instructor's Handbook Field Guide. I told her I was going to write that book. And I said, I want to take every single chapter and make it operational. And so that came out about, a month ago? Yeah.
How do we get that book?
You have to go to our website, cfibootcamp.com, the online store. It'll be there. I think it's $58. But anyway, it'll take every single chapter and it'll make it operational. And it has an inset of the most important things in that chapter you need to know. So it's good for, you need to use the information. It's no good if you can't use it, right?
Right.
And that's the problem with it.
Yeah. This reminds me of little Felipe going to a school to learn to fly.
Yeah.
I was... probably at that time I was around 11, 12, and I went to the school in North Perry. Mm-hmm. I said, I want to learn to fly. So he says, you pay $395 for your online ground school, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get an FAR, a plotter, and an E6B. Sound familiar, great, right? You're set to go. So this guy gives me this and says, this is the FAR. Go home and read this.
Oh, wow.
Now, you're talking about an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
Giving him an FAR.
Yeah.
And saying, go home and read this. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing, right? Like, it's like, and I feel like that 11-year-old kid reading an FAR is an instructor coming with a commercial certificate to become an instructor and is reading the aviation instructor handbook. Mm-hmm. Zero experience about any of that nothing. Stuff. So it's just like, okay, yeah, I read it. I don't think they're really retaining it because they don't have the
framework.
That makes sense. That's why my students are doing what they're doing.
Right, they don't have that. They don't have
the skill. And I feel like what you did was rewrite this whole book in a form that it's easy to digest, easy to to bite and be able to
And you
process.
Can use it. That's the thing. So you say, oh, I see. Like we have the domains of learning, right? The cognitive domain, affective domain, and the psychomotor domain. And so I explain what those are. They're like a space where you are. You're either thinking about something, you're thinking about how you hate it or you love it, or the last thing is the doing, the psychomotor part. If you're trying to teach a student and they're like a steep turn, and it's their first steep turn, and you decide you're going to explain something to them, and you look at them and you go like, okay, what's happening here is the horizontal component of lift is robbing you from the vertical component of lift, blah, blah, blah. They're not hearing any of that. So you have to manage the domain. You have to say, I have control. Then you take them out of the psychomotor domain and you put them into either the affective domain, is it scary or is it not scary, or you in the cognitive domain. And that's tools that you can use, like using Maslow's hierarchy of needs to see if a student's ready for a flight, right? We use that as a tool, right? It's a tool.
It's stuff that we use every day unconsciously.
Yes.
So what we're trying to do is bring that up to the attention of a new teacher so they can identify and say, hey, this guy is hungry. He's not going to be listening to what you're you're talking about. So
yep, you got it right.
It's sad that it's
you
like
don't need
that.
The book. You don't need the book. Well,
I think everybody needs a book. Again, like you said, you know, I think it's, you know, I've had a CFI instructor. I was writing down the other day. I was for 10 years already. Mm. I feel like I started doing this yesterday.
Yeah,
we were doing that survey and migration.
I'm right. I remember that.
Oh my god. 10 years.
For the flight review. Yeah.
For the flight review. But again, it's 10 years, and if you there's really the continuing education for CFI is doesn't really talk about that. No. Right? There's nothing in fact, there's nothing about psychology, I don't think. Mm-mm. In any of the flight instructor refresher courses.
Nothing. Just gained by experience. So we have no real education, continuing education of education. We have technical subject areas. But we don't have anything to say, here's how to be a better teacher. We don't really have that.
What would be your advice to an instructor that is either going to start now or is already an instructor? There's two different people, right? The ones that are going to start now and one that is been an instructor for a long time and wants to refresh and come back up and get current.
I see. And come back into it, right?
Come back into it.
Yeah, so we have a lot of like reinstatements we do for ex-airline, for ex-people who've been doing things and decided they didn't want to be a flight instructor anymore and then said, now I need to be an instructor again. Mm-hmm. So we do have a captain's course we put together for that, we call it. So we refresh that knowledge. But the things to do or the hardest things are, if you're a reinstatement, you're not going to be tested necessarily in the fundamentals of instructing, so you have that burden off of you. But if you are a student of that, then this is an area where it will be difficult. Right, and so I'd say if you have anything to memorize, if that's your DPE, to do that 2 weeks before your test, not before, because you'll just have to do it all over again. Right, so don't start on that. Start on concept, and then try to find something that, like we made these things called FOI roadmaps. They're a mind map for every chapter of the FOI, to how are things related, like what is human behavior? There are four subsets, and this is that kind of thing. Those kind of things are helpful, or make your own, right? But that's hard. So that's
it gives you. I saw that you presented that, and it's a good roadmap. You can see like a 10,000-foot picture of how it all comes together.
Yeah, that's the thing. And then read the handbook after you've seen that, because then you see the relationships to things, right? But just a linear read of that book is like, whoo.
Yeah, that's what you listen to when you want to go to bed.
Yeah,
or not listen to, but read.
Read. Well, you can Audible has a.
Do they have one for the?
They do for the fundamentals instructing. When I wrote this book, there was one chapter I wanted to review, and I didn't want to read it because I was jogging or whatever, so I just put it on Audible, and they had it there. It's actually narrated. It's not a synthetic voice. I don't know how they justified the cost of that, but Yeah, they narrated the entire book. And you can put it, what I like to do is on those things, put it like, yeah, not quite that, but 1 point something. So I can get, I know the content, I just want to see if there's anything kind of new. All right.
Yeah, I like the whole 2X.
Yeah, it's good,
It's, you know, it gets content quick. Sometimes people talk too slow.
Yeah. And it picks up the pace, right?
And it picks up the pace.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because I listen to a lot of Audibles. Mm-hmm. So I'm always constantly like, oh, this is a slow read or this is a fast read. And I got to throttle down or throttle up to maintain that cadence.
Yeah, that's what to do. You've got it exactly right. Yeah. But that's not a bad thing either, because when you're – a lot of people are really auditory learners primarily, and so they get things – but better by hearing. They can do even if you're distracted a little bit, you still can hear this stuff. It's just different points
for me, and this is the advice that I always give all the pilots, is give yourself as much exposure as you possibly can to as much information as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. So whether you're watching videos when you go home on from someone, whether you're listening to Audibles when you're driving, I mean, how much time do we spend driving in
cars? A lot of time,
right? So that time can be used spent listening to something and getting another, you know, it could be one thing that you get, but it's just one more thing that you have that in your tool belt, you know.
Yeah. And you should be engaged in learning. Learning shouldn't be just something you turn on for an hour a day or two. It's not high school. This is stuff you're really going to use.
Right.
It's not stuff you're going to just memorize and chuck usually.
Just think about how can you be better.
Yeah.
Never stop learning.
Yeah, that's the best way.
Mike,
that's my mantra.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming to the show.
Had fun.
I'm glad you had fun. I had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun in migration.
Yes, we did.
It's funny being at Oshkosh with no airplanes there.
I know. That was really weird.
And the bar was empty and closes at 9 o'clock.
It's very, yes.
But you get good service.
We did get good service.
Thank you so much for coming.
No problem.
Where can people find more information? You have a podcast as well. And
we
also have,
your
Power Hour. Talk to us about the Power Hour real quick.
All right. So the Power Hour is a 1 hour short subject on, not necessarily short, but it's a 1 hour dive into some aviation related content, like the math behind 8SUM pylons, like marketing 101 for flight. We've done 132 of those. And so you go to our website, cfibootcamp.com, you sign up for it, you get an email reminder. It's Saturdays for between 12 and 1 Eastern time. That's it. Then our podcast is Flight Training the Way I See It. That's opinion, mostly mine, as you can imagine, right? So we've got those things. You can find that on Spotify, Apple, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Mike, thanks so much for coming to the
you
show.
Bet.
And
thanks,
I love sharing the skies with you. I love people like you. You know, you're a good aviator, and you're making better pilots.
Yeah,
thank you for coming.
That's what we want to do. You bet. Thanks.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
We hope you've enjoyed the show. For more of our content, search on YouTube for Aviator Zone. If you know someone we should have on the show, please reach out at podcast@aviator.zone.